Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hello, my name's Andre Longley, and my guest this week on the Ham and Hyde podcast is Labour leader and leader of the opposition, Sir Keir Starmer. Keir is MP for Holborn and St Pancras, and we discuss his route into politics and what he sees as the radical solutions we need today. Keir Starmer, thank you very much for joining us on the Ham and Hyde podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's really good that we got round to it. It's brilliant to do it.
Obviously, we're talking on Zoom because we're talking at the start of February and we're still in lockdown. How are you finding lockdown? How's it being in the house?
Look, it's really hard. And I think, like everybody else, I think the third lockdown, the one we're in now, is proving to be the hardest of them all. I don't know whether it's just that it's been going on so long, or whether it's that we know with the vaccine that, you know, there is that light at the end of the tunnel and therefore it seems harder. But I think many people are finding this harder. It's frustrating, you know. I was elected as leader of the Labour Party in April of last year, and I haven't yet addressed a room full of people. I've only ever spoken into a camera to deliver speeches, etc. So there's a degree of frustration. But look, we're all in this in the same boat, if you like. And the sooner we can get that vaccine rolled out, the better.
Absolutely. We hired at the paper. We hired a chief reporter last April, I think it was, and I've only met her twice. Everything's been so remote, which is crazy.
Now, listen, then you have these flashes of emotion when you do things that you haven't done. So I went to one of the mass vaccination centres, and just the human emotion of seeing people smiling, human beings in a room, was incredible. Yesterday I went to Heathrow to see the operation there, but again, the smell and the feel of an airport, all these things that we're missing.
Yeah, it's gigs for me. Do you ever go to live music?
I do, yeah. I haven't been for a while, and I don't go that frequently anymore, but it's nothing. The Roundhouse, I think, was the last thing I went to.
Ah, really? What was that to say?
Edwin Collins was there. I can't remember now, a few years ago. So that was fantastic.
Of course, because he was one of your musical heroes.
My Desert Island Discs, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, he had a bit too much detail, but he had a stroke a few years ago, and then he's done a few gigs since then. So he went to the Roundhouse, and the Roundhouse is great anyway. So it's great to go there.
Yeah, no, I met him shortly after the stroke. I think it was at Queen's Park Literary Festival, and he's been finding his way back since then, but a remarkable man.
Yeah, anyway. And his son, again, too much detail, his son plays football with me on a Sunday now, so it's a small world.
You say now, obviously not right now.
No, not at the moment. We've had, I think, 6 games in the last, I don't know, 10 months, so not normally a weekly game is reduced to 6, so that was in, must have been September, October.
Anyway, you and I are in danger of talking about football for the next 20 minutes, so I'm going to change the subject now. What I want to talk about today is your background a bit, but how it leads into what your politics are and what your politics are, because obviously that's been something that's been talked about in the media and by various parties. So I want to get to that. What kind of child were you?
I was the second of 4. And we were a family growing up on the Surrey-Kent border. My dad was a toolmaker, so he worked in a factory as well. My mum was a nurse, but she gave up being a nurse when she had children, and then she was very ill for most of her life. She had a rare disease called Still's disease, which affected her very badly as time went on. So so I was one of 4 in a family on the Surrey-Kent border.
And what kind of a boy? Were you always out playing football? Were you listening to music? Was it all toys?
It was pretty football focused. So I think when I was growing up, I was playing at least for two teams every Saturday and Sunday, and most days I was playing football. So I always had this complete passion for playing football. So a lot of that, but I was doing it. I mean, I actually went to the Guildhall School of Music on a Saturday because I was a junior exhibitioner there for a number of years. And then at the school I was at, right, we played rugby as well. So quite a lot of sports and a lot going on.
What instruments do you play?
Almost nothing. I played the flute and the piano and a bit of the violin as well. But I don't anymore. I hasten to add, I'm not about to pick up an instrument under my desk and play anything. It's given me a lifelong love of classical music as well as popular music. But I don't play anymore.
Well, if anybody's got any secret recordings of Piers' musical past, send them in.
Well, so my claim to fame is that I had violin lessons with Fatboy Slim, who went to school with me. So there were the two of us in our violin lessons. So if you hear any of his songs, you'll know that that's where it all started.
it could have been you. So we know that you've talked a lot about you went into becoming one of the Surrey Young Socialists and got politicised that way. But when did that happen? Were you still at school when you got engaged in politics?
Yeah, I was. I think I joined when I was 16 years old and into the East Surrey Young Socialists, which was the sort of youth wing, if you like, of the East Surrey constituency Labour Party. There weren't many of us, I have to admit. I think the peak membership of the East Surrey Young Socialists was about five or six. So we were thinly spread. But that's when I first got involved in Labour Party politics.
I used to be news editor at the Surrey Advertiser in Guildford, so I know the Surrey landscape rings true. What was it that brought you into that, though? Was it people you were hanging around with or something you read or music? Was it a Bob Dylan moment? Or
no, it was a combination of things, really. I mean, we were a pretty Labour household. My dad was staunchly Labour. And so, you know, insofar as we talked politics much at home, the politics was Labour Party politics. I had friends who were interested in politics and we talked through, you know, Labour Party politics. And actually, the constituency party were very welcoming. And therefore, the sort of combination of that led me into the Labour Party pretty much as soon as I could join. I think 16 was the joining age. I can't quite remember now. As I say, our little band of five or six Surrey Young Socialists would then plot a different world from Oxted.
You've said before that obviously politics does move on from when you're a teenager. And, you know, clearly people grow up. You've also said more recently that you genuinely believe we need to be more radical than we are in terms of transformation of our country. At the moment, there's a perception, possibly unfairly, in the media that you're less radical than Labour's been in the last couple of years. How does that feel?
I think it's very important just to understand where we are politically at the moment. I think that, you know, since I've been leader of the Labour Party, we've had, 10 months, all of which has been a pandemic. And in those 10 months, I felt very strongly that the first priority should be understanding the scale of the defeat in December 2019, where we lost to everyone everywhere. Acknowledging that and accepting that, and part of my message to the Labour Party in my Doncaster conference speech, albeit on Zoom, was if you lose that badly, don't blame the electorate. You look at yourself and to begin to build trust and competence in the Labour Party. Now, of course, that on its own isn't enough to win an election, and nobody ever thinks it is, nor do I. That's the foundational stone. I actually think that now, as we come, you know, rolling out the vaccine, we are now getting to a real fork in the road. And that's where your question really brings us into sharp focus, because, you know, as we go forward, we now have to lay out our plans for what the future holds. And this will be Labour's plan into 2024. And I'm doing a speech, in fact, next week, I think more or less when this podcast comes out, which will make it clear that so far as the Labour Party is concerned, we're not going back to business as usual, because although it is true that the Prime Minister's delay and indecision and slowness have had profound consequences in the pandemic. You know, we've got 100,000 plus dead, more than any other country in Europe. We've got you know, the biggest recession of any major economy. But it was the structural weaknesses, actually, that were there, the inequalities, the lack of funding for public services, the lack of resilience for the NHS. They're the deep causes of this. And so I'll be setting out how the next stage of the political journey for the Labour Party now into 2024 is setting out that bold future plan. It's almost the sort of Attlee moment, I think, for us, the spirit of the Labour government after the first after the Second World War, in terms of the change that we need to bring about through a, you know, tackling those inequalities. And you know, after that sort of sacrifice and that sort of solidarity of the last year, I think that we've got to move forward, and so there is this fork in the road.
And how's that going to look? Because I think some on the left of the party are worried that that might just look like, well, we'd raise universal credit by 20% more than the Tories. And that's clearly not radical. That's
It's got to be much more profound than that. If you look, I've studied Michael Marmot, who's obviously local at University College, fantastic professor, has done a 10-year study of inequality, 2010 to 2020. And in that, he lays bare inequality of almost every type, you know, whether that's wealth, income, power, health in particular. An incoming Labour government in 2024 has to be bold enough to tackle all of that. Of course, universal credit is an important issue, but it is an issue within a much, much bigger project.
If you became Prime Minister and had a clear majority in Parliament, would you just get rid of universal credit entirely? And in which case, what would it be replaced with?
Well, I don't think universal credit has worked very well. There have been, at the same time as putting into some sort of universal form of benefits, which I'm not against some form of that, because I can, you know, all the different benefits weren't working very well. There was a lot of money taken out of the system, and there are structural problems. You know, the money isn't paid up front. Sometimes you have to take loans. The number of people I have in my constituency have got problems with universal credit. Is second only to the housing problem. I think there are other things I would change, Andre, as well. One of my concerns is that if you only have one benefit paid universally, it's usually paid to one person within the household. That is a problem where you've got domestic abuse, where you've got domestic violence, or just, you know, coercion within the house. So there are, I do think it needs reform. I mean, I've been quoted slightly out of context here. I'm not suggesting for the moment, in the middle of a pandemic, that you scrap the benefit systems that we've got now. Of course not. But in the longer term, I think there is a better structure for that. But that's only one part of it. The biggest challenge in terms of the fork in the road and building stronger going forward is a fair and thriving economy. We need a thriving economy. And if you look at the economy as we went into the pandemic, it was failing pretty well on its own terms. It was short-term investment with low standards, low skills, low returns, and lots of people on fragile contracts. And lots of people in the business world would say that wasn't the model that was delivering.
But how does the, for you, how does the improved economy actually help with issues of equality? You've talked before about the life expectancy of Somers Town compared to Primrose Hill, which I think 10 years was the figure quoted at the time. You get a stimulated economy. How does that help those people?
Well, the economy drives up standards and drives up wages, and we need a high wage, high standards economy, etc. But that disparity that you point out is very real. That 10-year, I mean, more or less, it may be slightly different figures now. I looked probably about 2 years ago. But the idea that within the constituency of Holborn and St Pancras, there is as big a gap as a 10-year difference in life expectancy is huge. Now, I mean, in Somers Town, obviously, you've got issues of housing, you've got issues of geography, you've got all of the work that's gone on around it. You've got issues, you know, I've been very, very keen to work with the businesses in King's Cross to try to get them into the schools in Somers Town and elsewhere, to give children and young people an idea of what is around them in terms of skills and possibilities. And so there's a, you know, for somewhere, you know, one of the things about Somers Town and other places is that there's a lot of work that really needs to be done in order to try and iron out some of these inequalities. And a lot, you know, quite a bit of that's going on. But to have a 10-year life expectancy difference is pretty stark within one. I mean, most people say, well, that'll probably be across the whole of the country or something, or even, you know, across several countries, not a few miles within the borough of Camden.
And obviously we're using this as an example. I suppose what I'm trying to get my head around is, what are the radical solutions you're talking about and to address this? What you've just mentioned there in terms of getting businesses involved and in schools and showing what opportunities are out there, is that an area? Is business the route you see to making these changes?
Oh, there has to be a new partnership with business. And that's one of the things I argued for in my CBI speech, which I gave, of course, on Zoom in the autumn, which is working with businesses to get that thriving but fair economy. And that is a very real partnership. There has to be more than that. But I think it's very difficult to see a way out of this. You cannot recover and go on to a better and different Britain if you introduce tax rises and throttle off any recovery, but equally if you cut back and go back to austerity. Both of those routes will throttle off the recovery. And so that thriving but fair economy is central to this. On its own, it's not enough, because obviously three central pillars are dealing with inequality between the ages of 0 to 18, because if you haven't dealt with it then, and that means a first class education for everybody, at the very least, and Sure Start and the support that goes around it. You then need a middle pillar, if you like, which is, you know, a fair economy that works for people in terms of skills and wages and dignity at work. And then, of course, the bit that we haven't done enough on as a country, which is security and dignity in older age. And if you know, the pandemic has brutally exposed a number of things, but one of them is the way in which security and dignity is often lacking when it comes to older people, particularly in the care sector.
Just in the last couple of days, the government's been talking about reforms to the health service. And what you've been saying obviously raises questions of social care. What's your initial impressions of the direction the government's taking at the moment?
Well, firstly, it's a recognition they got it completely wrong with the Lansley reforms, because they went down that route and, you know, Matt Hancock, Health Secretary, voted for Lansley, argued for Lansley. And so we've had 10 years or 8 years, 9 years now of a system which was never going to work, and everybody was told it wasn't going to work in the first place. So that is a huge problem. But what the government is replacing it is runs the risk of being not much better, because although a degree of local tendering is gone, there is still the possibility for, at a local level, contracts to go out and a lot more power into the hands of the health secretary. Now, obviously, there's a lot of detail to go through yet, but I would personally say that the priorities for the NHS, and my wife works in the NHS, and my mum worked for the NHS, and my sister worked for the NHS, so we've got a bit of NHS running through our blood here. But the at the moment, it's the waiting lists, because obviously there's a huge number of backed up operations, and it's the staff, the numbers of staff, and the security and pay of the staff, that are two crucial things. And I think a lot of people would be saying, is this really the time for this reorganisation? Because once the NHS is through dealing with the pandemic, which of course is still a huge strain at the moment, there is then, you know, this huge backlog of cases that they've got to get through. And so, I mean, but we'll look at the details of it. The other thing I should say, Andre, going to your other point, is there's not much in the white paper about social care, of course. The Conservatives for 10 years have been saying they're going to bring forward plans on social care. Plans never arrive.
On the issue of contracts, and in fact on business as well, there's a slight contrast, isn't there? Within your manifesto for the leadership, you talked about common ownership, bringing, you know, rail, mail, energy, etc. back into common ownership as an aim. And yet we're talking about the role of business in other areas. Is common ownership still on the table and in your sights?
I think there are four different forms of approaches. I think it's perfect. If you take an example in criminal justice, in my view, having worked in criminal justice, quite a lot of the contracting out of the private sector just didn't work, and it ended up with delays in court, delays in the administration of justice. And in certain areas, you know, probation is the classic example. The government then had to claw it all back in-house. So I think anybody who holds to the view that the private sector always delivers or the public sector always delivers is wrong. It's got to be a combination of the two. But to grow the economy going forward, we do need a future-looking economy where we've got that new partnership with business. And look at our constituency. You've got the Turing Centre there, just you know, in King's Cross, which is the most amazing centre for big data. I mean, the future is about big data. It's about high tech and IT, and a lot of that is around us in St Pancras and Hoban and St Pancras. And that's where you need a very strong partnership with business going forward. And I don't see the two, they're not mutually exclusive, and you've got to have both.
So I'm conscious we're slightly low on time, and I do want to get onto another topic. But just quickly, on common ownership, is nationalisation of energy, rail, water, is that in your sights?
I use the term common ownership because I actually think there are different forms of ownership. I'm very strong on co-ops, etc. But at the moment, what's in my sights is the fork in the road and the transformation we're going to have to make coming out of this pandemic. And that's, as I say, what I'm going to set out in some detail in the speech I'm giving on the day the podcast goes out. And so you'll have this and that alongside each other.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
It strikes me that compared to other times and other periods in politics, what we're facing now environmentally is an existential threat. We're not just talking about improving the world with politics. We're talking about actually what needs to be done to save it in anything resembling its current form. Labour's had the Green New Deal. Is that radical enough?
Well, I think the environment is absolutely central. And I think that one of the mistakes we made after the 08 crash was to take our eye off the climate change challenge. The security of the economy, obviously a huge thing, became so dominant that basically a decade was lost, I think, on environmental issues. Now, climate change has to be central to everything we do, which is why one of the commitments we made about an incoming Labour government in 2024 is that every policy, everything that we introduced, would be assessed for its impact, obviously in terms of value for money and other impacts, but also its impact on climate change, because it's got to be so central to everything we do. And just before Christmas, Ed Miliband for us outlined the plan we have for the next few years, if we were in government, to bring forward up to 400,000 jobs in the low carbon sector. So green jobs, for want of a better word, has to be central to everything that we do. There are real opportunities there, but it's also a duty, I think. There's also obviously the international element of this. And I'm very, very pleased that we now have President Biden, because I think that will usher in a new era globally around initially the Paris Agreement to tackle climate change.
On a very local level, obviously, one of the environmental changes in the last year has been the introduction of lots more traffic measures to try and reduce traffic, which has got a huge reaction and faced vocal opposition, as well as a lot of support. Do you think they, as a general policy, that's good? But also, do you think that we have to accept that to tackle environmental problems, it's going to hurt?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I think we need to understand what it is that Camden Council is trying to achieve. And they're trying to deal with climate issues such as air pollution. And air pollution in Camden is a very real issue. When you look at the statistics for air pollution, particularly in some areas in Camden and Hoban and St Pancras, they're pretty shocking. So something has to be done. And what's driving some of these changes is the desire to do something about that. Now, when you introduce traffic systems, some of them work, some of them don't. I think that is inevitable. the experience I've had in the 5.5 years I've been MP is that where some of them have been introduced, there's been a degree of concern about them. Then they settle down and actually they've worked out all right and most people have accepted them. Others, not so much. And some of the recent ones, I think, have been reversed now by the council. I think there needs to be that flexibility. But what's driving this is this desire to lower air pollution in Camden. That is the right thing to do. And if we can encourage people to use their cars less, then that is a good thing. And that involves, amongst other things, very good public transport.
And do you think it's indicative that actually it is going to hurt sometimes when to actually get the changes we need for the world?
Well, we've got to change the way that we do things in order to take account of climate change. And sometimes that is, it does mean people changing their habits and behaviours. I think a lot more people would walk and cycle where they can if they thought it was safer to do so. Not everybody can walk and cycle. I completely get that, particularly having had a mother who was in a wheelchair for many decades. It's not, not everybody can walk and cycle, but by and large, the easier and safer we can make it for people to walk and cycle, the better. That's only one aspect of it, of course.
If I could just ask one final quick question. Why do you want to be Prime Minister?
To change Britain for the future and to tackle the inequalities that are there and to make us an even better country than we are already.
Keir Starmer, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Andre.
Thank you so much to Keir for joining us on the Ham and Hive podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe and we'll be back again next week.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.